Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The Supreme Court immunity oral arguments and the ongoing Alvin Bragg trial. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews that they deserve on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast, through the miracle of Riverside, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, how are you?
Good, Andy. I made it almost all the way through the more than 2 hours of oral argument at the Supreme Court. This is one I had trouble following because I hadn't really read about much of it. So a lot of it was material I was unfamiliar with. But as it went on, I began to get the gist of it. But I just, you know, we've talked about this before when so much of our discourse has been so degraded and it's just so crappy and unedifying. These Supreme Court arguments are always civil, you know, by nature and fascinating.
Yeah, they really make you for today. It was, as you say, I had to move from one place to another. So I gave up at about the 2.5 hour mark. And I think it went on for another 10 or 15 minutes after that. But for that 2 hours, you really actually have hope that we like still have an adult society that can take things that are of importance and talk about them in a reasonable way, even among people who have a very wide range of views and predispositions about them. And what I thought really came through on in that regard, Rich, on this one is that right before your eyes, you could see that the dispute was narrowing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yep. It's like kind of so much of our politics and a lot of other disputes that aren't necessarily politics, but I think media has so pervaded our public discourse now, and I include social media in that, and there's so much bumper sticker rhetoric that the temptation for people is to go right to the extremes of their position. And it's those polls that we hear again and again in the messaging, which always oversimplifies everything. And you always know that there's a public position that people take, and then there's in their own mind what their red lines are that they wouldn't, you know, they really would give ground if they thought the other side would give ground, but since they're not, and it's all performance art, they have to stick to the polar opposites. But you know that if they ever got in a quiet room where, you know, there was normal give and take, they would give ground, the other side would give ground, and the dispute would narrow. Mm-hmm. And you eventually get to the point where you get the nub of the dispute, and you may need a third party like an arbitrator or a court or someone to decide what can't be negotiated. And I think what we saw today, very interestingly, in the Supreme Court argument was right before our eyes, the dispute narrowing.
Yeah. So let's set out the argument of Trump lawyers, this guy Sauer. Is it Jack Sauer? Sauer?
I think it's John Sauer.
John Sauer. So I thought at first he was going to get destroyed because the first question from Clarence Thomas in that deep resonance voice is where does this come from? You know, where is this immunity? But he made more sense as he went along. Not that I necessarily agree with everything than I would have thought. But his argument is that there's immunity for official acts and has a fairly broad view of official acts, although doesn't go all the way to everything Trump's being accused of, and we'll get into that a little bit too. But you have these official acts, and there's basically immunity. The only way you can get at a president over this stuff is impeach him and convict him, which has never happened. And then further, you need the president to be included in the statutes that the president's going to be prosecuted under to explicitly say they apply to the president. So this would be, you know, you got one gate you have to go through with the impeachment and conviction, which has never happened. And then you have another really narrow gate. And then he says a president can be prosecuted. Am I stating that correctly, first of all?
Yeah, he pushes on those two things. He's got a much more sweeping understanding of what immunity is, that is to say, what official acts are that a president would have coverage to prevent being criminally prosecuted. And then he's got a sweeping idea of what's known based on Justice Department memoranda from the Office of Legal Counsel, what's known as the clear statement rule, and what that covers. And just so, because we're going to need to talk about this, let me stop and explain what that is for just a second. The clear statement rule is that, and this is when we say it's a rule, it's not something a court has ever found, and it's not something Congress has ever enacted. It's an interpretive canon that the Justice Department has been following since around the Watergate era. I think that's when the first OLC opinions about it come out. And what it says is, if you have a criminal statute that somehow affects the duties and responsibilities and official actions of the president, then the Justice Department takes the position that that criminal statute does not apply to the president unless the Congress, in enacting the statute, has put into it a clear statement that it's meant to apply to the president. So the position that the Trump camp takes is basically, if the president's not named in the statute, he can't be prosecuted on the statute. I think that's that is an extreme statement of it. But that is that's the two things they're pushing on, the idea of a very broad immunity. Although, as you point out, Sauer, I wondered, Rich, as I listened to this, does President Trump know how much ground his lawyer is giving? Yeah. Because
he had a defense table, right? So he couldn't listen.
he couldn't listen. And maybe that was a good thing today, because I think, you know, Sauer had to have some credibility with the court. I think if you listen to Trump's position, it makes it sound like, you know, even things that are clearly private actions or that a court would see as private are, if they're actions that he takes as president, then he's got immunity for them. Now, to be fair to President Trump, he really hasn't taken that position. Like, for example, in the trial in Manhattan that is now ongoing, he has not taken the position that his repayments to Michael Cohen of the money that Cohen laid out to pay Stormy Daniels, Trump hasn't claimed that those are official acts of the presidency, even though they took place while he was president. So if you're imposing on or trying to impose on the former president the duty to be consistent and logical from beginning to end of his positions, I guess you could give him some credit for acknowledging that there are some things that a president can't be prosecuted for. But I really think he's got a much more grandiose idea of the sweep of immunity than John Sauer argued today, even though what he argued today was obviously much more extravagant than what the special counsel's willing to say.
Another sweeping aspect of Sauer's argument, as I understand it, so he conceded these, you know, conversations with private lawyers to do these things related to the election weren't official acts. But he seemed to be saying, as I understand it, that all the official stuff needs to be taken out of the indictment. Did I hear that correctly? Not just that you can't charge him over it, that this stuff doesn't belong like anywhere in the case. Was he saying that?
Yes, he kind of was. And what you're homing in on is something that I found untenable in the position of Mike Dreeben, who argued, interestingly, saying he was arguing on behalf of the Justice Department, not just Jack Smith, the special counsel. But one of the things, Rich, I think that is not sensible about being governed by, you know, progressive legal eggheads rather than, you know, common sense and American traditions is this idea of, should you have immunity up front or should you content yourself with the fact that you'll be able to defend yourself if there's a prosecution?
Right.
And what the Trump side is saying is the presidency can't function efficiently And it can't do – it's not so much the president's interest. The presidency can't do the things that must be done for the country if the president has to worry about criminal liability.
Right.
And what Dreeben, on behalf of the prosecution, says, on the other hand, is we at the Justice Department, of course, defend executive power and, of course, defend the presidency. But you don't have to have immunity, because if a president was prosecuted wrongly by the Justice Department, he would have a lot of defenses, including what Dreeben kept saying is – one of the things we have to recognize is in our modern governmental system, this is like the progressive administrative state that we now have, right? In our modern system, the president has a plethora of lawyers that he can consult before acting.
Yeah.
And that includes the attorney general. So if you prosecuted him, he wouldn't have to worry, because he'd have a state of mind defense. Because he consulted with the attorney general. And I'm thinking, well, as he's saying that, how many millions of dollars does he have to spend on his defense? And how paralyzed is American governance, does it become under the weight of the idea that the president could be investigated and potentially prosecuted after he leaves office?
This is one thing we'll get into with the Bragg thing, but I'm just going to jump ahead and mention it, and then we'll get right back to the Supreme Court here. There's this guy, Sugarman, I think maybe is his name, who's written a couple times in the New York Times about he's a law professor, I think, at BU or someplace.
This is the guy who wrote the column this week?
Yeah, yeah. So he thinks it's BS. And then he's like, I thought it was BS initially. Then I thought maybe there was something to it. Now I basically think it's BS. But then at the end, he's like, but, you know, we can find out. We can just try him, you know. And he has all sorts of avenues on appeal. And maybe he will win on those and should win on those. But we can just try him and find out. Like, but where is he getting all this campaigning time back, you know, in 2025, right? Or 2026. Right. Yeah, it's crazy, but
Rich, to that point, because I think it's important to since you've made the point, I want to stress it here. It's not just Trump's campaign time. It so happens that we have a former president here who is running for president, which is a historically very unusual circumstance. But in terms of the way American governance works, do we want Biden worried about whether he's going to be prosecuted for something he might have to do today? They can charge him and let's find out. Is that a good answer to this? Like one of the hypotheticals that was posed today, I think, by Sauer was, what if after Biden is out of office, a prosecutor from the other party wants to say that Biden aided and abetted swaths of illegal aliens coming into the country by failing to enforce the laws? Do we want Biden operating in a context that, you know, it's bad enough that we have the issue in front of us and the policy that has to be decided. Do we want Biden operating in a context where he has to worry about whether he's going to actually be prosecuted for aiding and abetting, illegal entries and whatever other array of crimes you could decide out of that? And the progressive answer to that, although I don't think this is the position they take with respect to Biden, but if we just take them at their word that this is their position, it's like, it's okay, you can charge them and we'll find out.
Yeah.
Is that the way we want our government to work?
Yeah. And as someone pointed out, I wasn't watching on TV, and sometimes I can't distinguish the voices. I don't know whether it was Alito or Gorsuch was saying, well, if you're going back to the you can rely on the advice of the AG, and that's a defense. They said, one of them said, well, wouldn't that just create an incentive just to get an AG is going to say everything you do is legal? That's sort of your blanket defense. And Dreeben's like, oh, no, that would never happen. You have to have the Senate confirmed, but you could have an acting attorney general. But I thought it was interesting, Andy, how both sides, Sauer and Dreeben, both had the, and they're not totally wrong, but both had this, their other safeguard arguments. So with Sauer, it's like, Jackson or others, like, but if you can't prosecute a president, what possible check is there on his illegality? I've seen Jackson's, her her riff has been played a lot on cable TV. Like, you know, this is just going to be a free fall, free for all of criminal activity if you can't prosecute a president. And Sauer says correctly, well, there are all these other checks, right, against illegality, political, and ultimately impeachment. And Dreeben was sort of saying, well, there are all these checks on political prosecutions, right? That would never happen. I kind of laughed out loud a couple times. He's like,
yep.
He said something like, I don't know what the case was, but if a politicized prosecution would be unconstitutional under Ward or something like that. Oh, really? Yeah,
right. No, it's great. He says, you know, they take an oath, Rich. Prosecutors take an oath. You know, we never politicize our powers. Along those same lines, he also said that, you know, you have to go through the grand jury. You know, that's another check on abusive prosecutions. And Alito asked him, Alito, who's a longtime prosecutor in New Jersey, asked him, you know, well, what about the old saw about how a prosecutor could, you know, indict a ham sandwich? Mm-hmm. And he says, aren't there cases? Have you ever heard of a case, Mr. Dreeben, where the U.S. attorney really, really, really wants to prosecute someone and the grand jury stops him? Mm-hmm. So Dreeben says, well, Your Honor, there are such cases. And Alito says, well, yeah, there are eclipses occasionally, too.
Yeah. So a hypothetical that came up a lot and came up at the very beginning, it was returned to repeatedly, that gets to the difficulties here or ambiguities, is bribery, right? So you're being, maybe Robert's brought this up, that you're being bribed to appoint an ambassador. And appoint an ambassador is really a core presidential responsibility. I think that even falls within Dreeben's core of official duties. But, you know, bribery is not. You're taking a bribe is not part of your responsibilities and is illegal. So where do we put? How do you think about that?
Well, I think about it in a practical way because I actually had this case in 2000 after President Clinton left office. I was a prosecutor, and we had the we caught part of the cases that arose out of the pardon scandal. And the essential theory of prosecution there was that there had been a quid pro quo, that essentially there had been a bribe. And that was the case with respect to Mark Rich, most famously, who spread a lot of money on the Hillary Clinton Senate campaign, the Democratic National Committee, and maybe a couple of other things that were of interest to Clinton. And then the part of the case I had in New York was it dealt with the pardon that Clinton gave to convicted racketeers in a Hasidic Jewish community in upstate New York called New Square. And the idea was that those people block vote based on what the Rebbe signals. So the idea was that you give them a pardon and then they'll block vote for Hillary because Hillary's Senate campaign was coming up. So we actually had to deal with this in a practical way. And I came to the conclusion that you could not prosecute Clinton on this. And my sense of it was you could prosecute him for bribery, but that wouldn't vitiate the pardon because the pardon's an official act of the presidency. So if you caught him taking a bribe, yes, you could probably prosecute him for bribery. But that didn't mean that you could – what they seem to be suggesting today was that there – to me, I think of these things as disconnected, even though they're obviously intimately interrelated. I think of the crime – and the official act. I don't believe you vitiate an official act of the presidency through the criminal justice process. I think that would have been a foreign idea to the framers. I think what would happen is you could prosecute a president for what would be deemed to be private criminality because even though it involved an activity of the presidency, there's enough law on the issue on the point that you can conclusively say that bribery is not an official act of the president. There's no authority to take bribes in the Constitution or anywhere else. But the president does have the authority, unquestionably, to issue pardons. So it's actually a kind of a fascinating story, because if you knew who the players were, especially in New York, who were considering this, and you just thought, this is why I always say that in the old days, people used to check their politics at the door, because my position in this thing, as much as I despised the Clintons, was very pro-Clinton. I didn't think they could be prosecuted. And there were progressive Democrats who were friends of mine in New York who were on the other side of the argument, who felt very strongly that they should be prosecuted. And ultimately, the Justice Department decided not to prosecute them. But I think, to me, the assumption of that discussion today in the court seemed to me to be, maybe you heard it differently than I did, that the bribe would vitiate the official act. And my take is that you have to separate out the two. If you have enough evidence for bribery, you can prosecute them for bribery, because that's not an official act. But as far as the official act goes, the remedy is impeachment. And you could say, if you want, that, well, how good, what kind of a remedy is impeachment? Because the guy could be out of office. Like, Clinton was out of office. He did this on his way out the door, right? But the thing is, if you're going to go by the original intent of the Constitution, the original understanding of the Constitution, that original understanding included, as was pointed out today during the oral argument, that presidents had no term limits. You know, it wasn't assumed that just, you know, that a president was going to do something and be out the door.
Right.
So I just think, to me, there's no satisfactory answer to this. But I think the correct answer is that the official action stands unless Congress has a way to undo it. And if you say, but a president can't, then, you know, the president's beyond the reach of justice. Well, if you could, if you have enough evidence, you can prosecute him on the bribe. But if you don't, then the answer to that is you have to have something has to give in this system. And what we've decided is that separation of powers is essential to liberty. So you can't have a system where the Congress can enact laws that that attrit the president's power, and that's going to result in some unjust outcomes from time to time. But, you know,
I thought that was one of Sauer's best points. This came up in some contexts. Well, you know, the president maybe couldn't be prosecuted for X, Y, and Z in that instance. And he's like, well, I think the founders were willing to deal with the possibility of under enforcement or under prosecution in order to preserve this larger infrastructure that protects our liberty, which reminds me a little bit in a different context of the famous Scalia statement that something can be legal and stupid, right? So, Andy, my ears also perked up when I'm pretty sure it was Roberts directly criticized the circuit court ruling, because the circuit court apparently has a line in there somewhere saying that, well, if the president's being prosecuted, that must mean there's a pretty good case for him being prosecuted, so he should be prosecutor. I'm paraphrasing, but something like that. But the Dreeben said, well, that's a tautology. And Roberts is like, you know, I think it's a tautology too. And this is a problem with the ruling. So what do you think the possibilities of this being sent down or part of it being sent back down? There's a lot of speculation that there could be a remand here, which for Smith's purposes is a defeat, you know, at least a major tactical defeat, any further delay.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I think we saw the court cause both sides to give ground today. The Trump side obviously gave ground on whether there are acts in the indictment that are non-official acts that would be subject to prosecution. There's a whole argument, of course, about whether the statutes involved should be applied against the president. That's another legal question, and we'll have to. That's the clear statement doctrine, and we'll have to see what the court has to say about that. But Trump obviously gave ground on whether everything in the indictment is official. The lawyers took the position that not everything is, even though they have a more robust idea of what is than the other side does. And the special counsel side, which is also the Justice Department's side, took the position that whether you call it immunity or not, there are official core activities of the presidency that are not subject to prosecution. So it seems to me that that tees it up with the court having narrowed the dispute. There's a very good chance, it seems to me, that this could be sent back to Judge Chutkan to go through the indictment, decide what's an official act and what's not an official act. And Rich, to your point, that's a victory for Trump because it extends the number of proceedings, but understand these would still be proceedings within the context of immunity, which means they're pretrial appeals. So it's not like Judge Chutkan would decide it and then that would be the end of it. Chutkan would decide it and then either side could appeal to the D.C. Circuit and back to the Supreme Court. If that's where they come out, the chance that this case would be tried prior to the election seems to me to be non-existent.
Got it, because you just answered the question I was going to ask. It wouldn't sound to me like it would take very long for Chutkan to, you know, she could sit down an afternoon and do this, right? But it entails a whole different layer of appeal.
It might be more complex than that because there's not a bright line. There was a lot of talk today about the D.C. Circuit's Blassingame case, which we've talked about before. That's a case that arises out of the civil case that's been brought against Trump by a couple of Capitol Police officers and I think about 10 Democratic Congress critters, including Swalwell from California. And in the Blassingame case, where the court said, the D.C. Circuit said, that it could move on to the next stage of litigation, which is like discovery, et cetera, they tried to lay out a test for distinguishing what's a private versus what's an official action. And the only bright line they really came up with, Rich, is to say that office seeking is different from official action. So if what you're doing is something in the nature of campaigning for office to be elected or reelected, that would be private activity. And otherwise, if you're acting within the ambit of your presidential responsibilities, that's official activity. But Judge Greg Katsas, in his concurrence, which was stressed today by Sauer on behalf of Trump, noted that it's not always easy to distinguish because, like, for example, I think I've said this before, if a president gives a campaign speech, that's presumably private action. But if in the middle of the campaign speech he says, and that's why I'm removing the Secretary of State from power and replacing him with, you know, X person, well, that's an official act. So just because something seems to be in the context of one doesn't mean that that's dispositive necessarily. And it might be a lot harder for her to sort out what's private from what's official than it seems at first blush. I think there'd be big evidentiary hearings. You'd have to go into what evidence the two sides. So it's not just a straight, clear legal question.
So, but you're to just restate it. Your belief is that if it's sent back down to her to do this, that this case will not be heard, is unlikely to be heard before the election.
Yes, because this would be a mammoth task. I don't think it would be that easy to do. It would be appealable. And the other thing we have to bear in mind, Rich, is even if the court sends her back the case and they've decided, so she doesn't have to do anything on immunity, she's still got 2 or 3 months' work to do with pretrial hearings, pretrial rulings, et cetera. In fact, one of the things that came up today, I think it was Justice Thomas asked Sauer, have you made a motion in this case that Jack Smith's appointment as special counsel violates the Constitution? And he said, we haven't done it in this case, but we have down in Florida, and we believe that the position that was argued by former attorneys general Meese and Mukasey is correct and that his appointment is unconstitutional. So there's a lot of big issues yet that haven't even been raised completely in the Washington case.
So do you think there's any chance that it will be sent by the Supreme Court back to the Circuit Court?
No, I think they'd send it back to Judge Chutkan.
Okay. And on responsibility, presidential duties, before we move on, I'm a little skeptical of the Draben case, that there's just this core. You know, maybe some things are more central to the chief executive than others, but just so if there's not constitutional, authority and responsibility to do things, why is the president doing them anyway, so it seems to me all of it would be important, and the things that would be most likely to be contested or give rise to a case he's done something illegal maybe are on the not directly involve the core. So I'm a little skeptical of that core concept. And he seemed to, if I understood it correctly, to when it came to the commander in chief stuff, to be was commander in chief within his core? Because that also entails a bunch of other things a lot of things fall under that umbrella.
Yeah, this goes to the conflict that the Justice Department has here, because they want to protect Biden at the same time that they prosecute Trump, right? And it's hard to do both. So they want to give Biden the wide berth that they think the president's entitled to, but they want to reserve their ability to successfully prosecute Trump. So with Commander in Chief, Rich, what he said was, yes, that's a core presidential responsibility, because it's actually expressly spelled out and stated states it, but it's a power that's declared in Article 2 that the president has. So the caveat he said there was that he wanted to add that the Constitution also gives Congress a lot of power to act in national security, including war powers, which is true. But I think going to your point of how hard it is to state what the core of presidential authority is, and to my mind, how inappropriate it is for a court or even Congress, for that matter, to say what the president's authority is under the Constitution. I think, as Hamilton said, some things you can't make antecedent rules about because the threats that might come against the nation are so infinite that it would be foolish to try to draw those lines. I think a good parallel for this is, Rich, another provision that we've talked about a lot, which is the Presidential Records Act. In the Presidential Records Act, look at the acrobatics that Congress went through to try to capture everything and say that the president needed to document it and archive it. They didn't talk about core responsibilities. They said that some things the president does are just ceremonial, and some things the president does are just ministerial, but they're still presidential actions. Mm-hmm. So the scope of the presidency, I think the reason nobody wants to sit down and say what it is because we don't know what it is until there was some exigency where the president had to act. And in the E. Jean Carroll case, remember, this was a big deal on the defamation that Trump allegedly did while he was president. And after Judge Kaplan decided it, the Second Circuit said, we're not going to define what the president's duties are. So they kicked it to a court in D.C. that deals with federal employment. And that court came back and said, we're not presumptuous enough to say what the president's powers are. We can give you some principles about like what's official and what's not official. But, it would be very presumptuous to undertake to say we will now define the full authority of the presidency. And I think, if you look at the Constitution, the framers, with a lot of exactitude, lay out in detail what the powers of Congress are, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at Article 2 isn't like Article 1 at all in that regard. What they say is, we're reposing in the president the executive power, and we're making a commander-in-chief. Mm-hmm. And they don't lay out what all that means, because who knows what it means?
Yeah. So two other points before we move on, because we got to get to Bragg. But Dreeben often said, in defense of his position, well, you're making it sound like presidents are going to be prosecuted all the time, but only Trump has gotten prosecuted. And there are two ways you can look at that. He mentioned Nixon too, would have been, I guess. But either Trump is uniquely bad, and there's a case for that, but also there's just a Trump exception, and he's being targeted in a way others wouldn't have. And then final point on this, when the Supreme Court took this up, the argument, if I remember correctly, from the MSNBC crowd is there's nothing to see here. There's nothing to argue about. This is a slam dunk. They're just delaying for no reason. And then you have this fantastically complex argument for 3 hours where I couldn't, on a lot of things, I don't know what I think yet. So the idea that this was there's nothing to litigate or argue about here, which obviously is a motivated argument because they just want to slam through the trial as quickly as possible, is completely absurd.
Yeah, those two points, Rich, are of a piece, because part of Trump derangement is this notion that Trump is a sui generis figure and that we can just make rules about him. We can just see the unique evil in him that makes everything so much easier for people who are of that mind to see. And they take the position that it's preposterous to think that since we're only dealing with Trump, it's not like we're making rules that are going to affect a normal person, right? And the thing is, Mike Dreeben's a smart guy. He's been at the Justice Department for a long time. He's argued a lot of cases before the Supreme Court. If you took Trump out of the equation and you said to Mike Dreeben, well, if we get the court to set a precedent on an issue of importance, don't you think the Justice Department would then rely on that precedent in the next case? And he would say, of course we would. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the way the law works. And of course, that is the answer. So it may be that no president's ever been prosecuted before Trump. But that doesn't mean if they set a precedent that makes it easier for that to happen, that it won't happen in the future. And how on earth could you say, and I say this as somebody who said that Trump can't win, right? Trump is obviously in a position in the polls where if the election were today, it would be a very, very close election. And the reason that I note that is Trump's argument in the campaign is, I'm your retribution. If I get in, we're gonna address the stuff that's gone on the last, you know, 4 years. Mm-hmm. So you have a president who is got a very good chance of being the next president, at least if you look at the polls today. And he's promising that if he gets in, he's going to start prosecuting people who heretofore have not been targets of prosecution. So how anyone could so confidently say, oh, yes, this is only for Trump and whatever precedent gets set here, it's sui generis and it'll never apply. That's ridiculous.
So on the Bragg trial, what have we learned so far, if anything? So we had jury selection and we've had Pecker testifying, the National Enquirer, former National Enquirer official. I believe he's still testifying today.
Yeah, that's right. He comes back today. I don't think he hadn't started cross-examination yet, at least the last time I looked in. So what's happened, Rich, is that this is the two ships passing in the night perception of this case, but depending on which camp you're in. So the New York Times writes that Bragg has a mountain of evidence. He's just got an immense amount of evidence. And, you know, people like me come back and say, yes, he has an immense amount of evidence because it's very easy for prosecutors to collect a lot of evidence about things that don't violate the law. You know, he's got Pecker has come in and told him the whole story about how him and Cohen's told them the same thing, how they planned to do this catch and kill scheme where they were going to, you know, get these stories from women who alleged that they had affairs with Trump and obtain the exclusive rights to them and then not make sure those things didn't get published. And Bragg has presented a lot of evidence about that. And he's apparently going to present a lot more evidence about that. But the problem he has is that's not illegal. It's not illegal to suppress, to scheme to suppress politically damaging information. And I think what we're seeing here is, I have to say, it's pretty much what we discussed as we looked at what was going to happen, you know, last week before the case even started. And that is that he doesn't have a crime to address the thing he says happened here, which is that Trump stole the 2016 election. And he's in this irrational position where he's arguing to the jury that that's what Trump did, but the charges in the case relate to actions that Trump took after the election was over. And logically, you can't steal something by doing something after the thing you stole, after the theft occurs. You know, you have to have crimes that lead up to the theft. And what he's trying to do with Pecker and what he'll try to do with Cohen is hoodwink the jury into thinking the case is about a scheme that ran up to the 2016 election. But the problem he has is what he called a scheme in his statement of facts that he published at the time the indictment was filed, and what his subordinate prosecutor, Matthew Colangelo, expressly called in court this week a conspiracy. The problem he has is that it's not a conspiracy. It's not an agreement to commit a crime, the things that went up to 2016, to the 2016 election. And the crime that he wants to say that they were committing is a campaign finance violation that he doesn't have authority, Bragg, as a state prosecutor, to bring. And that was not a campaign finance violation under the standards applied by the two authorities Congress has reposed authority to enforce federal campaign law, namely the Justice Department and the Federal Election Commission. So the whole thing to me is just preposterous. And it turned out this week, the big disclosure in court on Tuesday was that Colangelo expressly said that he should be allowed to call what Trump, Cohen, and Pecker were engaged in a conspiracy, because the business records felony statute that Bragg is trying to prosecute here says that if you falsify business records with a fraudulent intent to commit or conceal another crime, that's the thing that makes it a felony. What they want to argue now is that the other crime is a New York election statute that makes it a crime to basically engage in a deceptive scheme through unlawful conduct to influence the outcome of an election. The problem with that theory is you still have to show unlawful conduct. And the unlawful conduct he wants to rely on is the federal campaign finance laws. So it's completely circular. And Rich, here's the cherry on top. The election law statute that he now wants to rely on, the big conspiracy statute that he wants to, on the basis of which he wants to be able in front of the jury to call this a conspiracy that goes back to 2015, it's a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
So what Bragg is now saying is that Trump committed misdemeanor business records falsification in order to cover up misdemeanor election law violations.
And we should
make it not a felony, 34 felonies, right. For which he could be sentenced to 136 years in prison.
So the state statute, it needs the law that's being broken in the state's election statute is federal election law. That's the
it's circular how you get there, or it's involved how you get there. But basically, what you have to show is that you agree they conspired to influence the outcome of an election by unlawful conduct.
Right.
So what's the unlawful conduct? The federal campaign finance violation.
But what
Bragg wants to hoodwink people into thinking is the unlawful conduct is scheming to suppress politically embarrassing information. The problem he has is it's not a crime, and that's what campaigns do.
Yeah, and again, the unlawful contribution would have been the Cohen payoff to Stormy Daniels, his original payment.
Yeah, he wants to say two things, even though neither of these is charged in the indictment. The Cohen payment to Stormy Daniels. And also, the National Enquirer paid $150,000 to Karen McDougal.
Right.
And they want to say that was not booked properly either. But it's not charged in the indictment. But who cares what's charged in the indictment, right? We're making it up as we go along.
And is there some question of whether this the state election law would just apply to local and state races rather than a federal race?
There is that. That issue is a live issue. It's been preserved for appeal. In the pretrial motions, Trump made what I thought should have been the successful argument that with respect to campaigns for federal office, Congress's campaign finance laws have preempted the field. That doesn't mean the state's laws are no longer operative, but they're only operative with respect to campaigns for state and local office.
Mm-hmm.
Trump did make that motion. Judge Merchan, you'll be shocked to hear, denied it. So he's letting Bragg proceed. But I think that could be a basis for throwing the case out on appeal if we get to that point.
And final thing, we got to go in a minute. So let's say there's at the end, the Trump people ask the judge, you know, just let the jury consider the misdemeanor. And what happens? Can you do that if the statute of limitations has expired on the misdemeanor?
So here's we're talking about the difference between the law and what Judge Merchan might do, right? Which may not be the same thing. Under the Sixth Amendment, as it's been, and the speedy trial component of your constitutional array of due process rights, what the Supreme Court has said is that a case has to be thrown out if a prosecutor has tactically delayed in order to deprive the defendant of a defense, which could be a factual defense, like you wait until a witness is missing and then you know, an exculpatory witness, and then you indict, or it could be a legal defense. So here, I think Trump, as I understand New York law, Trump is entitled to ask for a lesser included offense instruction to the jury, meaning if it would be rational for a jury to find that he committed the misdemeanor, not the felony business records offense, which I think would be rational on the facts as we understand them, then the jury has to be given the possibility of returning a verdict on a guilty verdict on the misdemeanor, not the felony. Now, Bragg will push back and say the misdemeanor no longer exists because the statute runs. In other words, he's going to take his abuse and try to turn it into a shield for himself, which he shouldn't be allowed to do under the Sixth Amendment. Judge Merchan, if he takes that position, should reject Bragg's application and give the jury the opportunity. Here's the big question at the end, Rich. Do you tell the jury that if you convict him on the misdemeanor but not the felony, that you're effectively acquitting him?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you just say to the jury, just tell us what you find, and then we'll figure out what it means? Bragg will be on top of the prosecution table telling Merchan, you have to tell the jury that if they do this, if they convict him on the misdemeanor, he walks.
Right, to sort of Trump, the possibility of the misdemeanor.
Right, and Trump is going to be on his table screaming, there's no reason to tell them that. What we're asking for is what we're entitled to, which is a lesser included offense instruction. All you have to do is tell the jury you can convict them on one or the other. Mm-hmm. You don't have to tell them. Sentencing is not the jury's business. Throwing a case out on legal grounds is not the jury's business. You don't have to tell them that he walks.
Well, it's a very tricky and sensitive question. Fortunately, there's a fair-minded and objective judge who'll be making this call.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, I actually don't think Trump should be convicted on the misdemeanor, because I don't think, even with the misdemeanor, you have to prove that he acted with fraudulent intent. It's not enough to show that the records, whatever records he kept, that there are inaccuracies in them. You have to show that he falsified the records with fraudulent intent. Even if you don't find that the fraudulent intent was to commit or conceal another crime, you still have to find fraudulent intent. And to me, Rich, this criminal case is just like the civil case. Where's the fraud? Where's the victim? Mm-hmm. Who got defrauded here?
Yeah.
I don't see it.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich.